guest this hour says tribal culture, or the human need for connectivity and unity, might be the key to our psychological survival. We are going to discuss what we can learn from tribal societies and welcome your thoughts and views as we talk with the author of Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sometimes the worst of times can bring out the best in us and can foster a sense of togetherness. However, that's missing in our modern day society, according to our guest. And one example is the problems that are faced by many of our military members when they return home after serving in a tightly knit unit with a common goal, and find themselves alone in an independent and divided culture. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Do you think we're connected enough as a society? Why or why not? What do you think we can do to become a better community, a better state, a better nation? Do you have any experiences overcoming hardships with the help of others? We'd love to hear from you as we talk with our guest, Sebastian Younger, a freelance journalist and New York Times best-selling author of 5 books, including his latest, Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us about Tribe. Why the name? Why is that the name of the book? What does it mean?
Well, I think tribe is a very evocative word that a lot of people have powerful associations with, some negative, but mostly positive. I think for most people it suggests a dedication to the common good, to a kind of communalism, and to a very interconnected life with other people in your tribe, obviously something that's been diminished in modern society.
Yeah, why do you say that that tribal culture might be the key to our psychological survival?
Well, I mean, to be clear, as a journalist, I refrain from making personal opinions, but what the research seems to show is that people psychologically do best in groups. We're primates. We're a social species. Virtually all the primates are. And whether it comes to dealing with trauma or raising infants or all of life's tasks, doing them in a group is what we're clearly wired for. And when we don't do that, and many of us do not in modern society, there's a great liberation in that, but there's also a kind of psychological liability. And you can see it in mental health statistics, mental health statistics of modern society versus, say, traditional tribal societies where, for example, suicide is virtually unknown.
I'm going to see if we can reestablish our connection with you, Sebastian Younger, as we are hearing some strange static and feedback on your line. Every once in a while, if we call back, we might be able to get a better connection. So we will do that, and we will remind listeners that we are talking with Sebastian Younger, author of Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging. And we welcome your questions for him. We welcome your input, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. And maybe you have an example you'd like to share about how people can come together in tough times, perhaps. I mean, one example that comes to mind just happened yesterday in southern Wisconsin, anyway. A lot of people coming together, trying to help each other out after we had those violent thunderstorms in Madison, anyway. Trees down and problems galore, and people kind of helped out each other, helped out neighbors, and tried to clean up from that bad storm. Same thing happens after big snowstorms or blizzards where your neighbor will help you shovel out. That's the kind of one example of the tribal culture that our guest says could that we don't have as much anymore, and it would help us if we would develop that more. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Again, our guest, Sebastian Younger, author of Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging. Well, it sounds like we have a little better connection, so that's good, Sebastian.
Great.
Let's talk a little bit about your own personal story about how someone really influenced you in your hitchhiking trip across the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a pretty well-off suburb, which, as I found in my research, that as income goes up in the society, individualism goes up, and often there's a real loneliness. I certainly experienced that in the suburb that I grew up in, and I came to sort of manhood thinking I'd never really been tested in any real way, and I set off to hitchhike across the country, you know, partly to see my own country and partly as a kind of rite of passage. You know, I had a backpack filled with gear, and off I went. And I wound up, I grew up on the East Coast, and I wound up in Gillette, Wyoming, one very, very cold fall morning. And I couldn't get a ride. Guys were throwing beer bottles at me out of pickup trucks, and, you know, it was this big, wide-open Western landscape, and I was just a kid. I was very, very intimidated by it. And after a couple of hours, I saw this guy walking towards me from town, and he didn't look good. He was a big guy, and he was clearly pretty marginal. His clothing was filthy, and his hair was matted, and he was very intimidating looking to me. He had a lunchbox, and he came up to me, and he asked where I was going, and I said, going to California. And he said, well, how much food you got? And I got very suspicious. I mean, I would give food to anyone who was hungry, but I didn't think that's what was going on. I thought he wanted to rob me. I thought he wanted to get me to open my bag up. And I had a lot of camping gear and all this stuff. I'd saved up my money. I felt very vulnerable out there, and so I lied. I said, I just got a little cheese. And he explained that he lived in a broken-down car in town. He was homeless. And that every morning he walked 3 miles out to a coal mine outside of town to see if anyone was sick that day and if he could pick up a shift. And as it happened on this particular day, no one was sick. And as he said, showing me the lunchbox, so I won't be needing this. He won't be needing his lunch. He said, I want you to take my lunch because you're going to need every bite of food you can get to California. And it was a bologna sandwich and an apple and a bag of potato chips. I think he probably got it from a local church. And, you know, he gave me his lunch, but he gave me an incredible lifelong lesson. I mean, lots of people are generous. He'd been generous, but lots of people are. But what he'd done was he'd seen me from town, and a marginal person himself, and had taken responsibility for me. He'd kind of, in my mind, as I understood his action, he'd kind of walked out there to check on a brother. And by that I mean that he was homeless and marginal, and he thought I was. I wasn't, but he thought I was. And in that sense, we were kind of in the same tribe, as I came to understand it, and he'd gone out to check on me. And it was a very profound act that really has informed me about decent behavior my entire life.
Yeah. And when did you notice that the lack of community, of tribal qualities in our society, when did you notice that happening, and what did you find?
Well, I grew up in an affluent suburb where we didn't know our neighbors. We certainly didn't depend on them for our livelihood, for our survival, but we didn't even know them. And I felt like I was living a weird community-less life where every family was its own individual unit. And I studied enough anthropology in college, and I read enough even when I was a child to understand that this was new in human history, that for most of human history, people lived lives that were very, very interdependent on other people in their communities. And that very suddenly Western society was no longer doing that. And even when I was young, it really made me wonder what are the consequences of that. I was very enamored of the American Indians. As many young boys are, I think, it's sort of a common thing. And when I was a little bit older, I was very lucky to encounter a sort of uncle figure, a kind of mentor figure named Ellis, who was half Lakota Sioux and half Apache. He was the uncle by marriage of my best friend. And Ellis, I remember Ellis saying to me when I was in my early 20s, I knew him for many years. He said, you know, it's funny, all along the history of the frontier in this country, the white people were always running off to join the Indians, but the Indians never ran off to join the white people.
Yeah. So, yeah, you do focus in the book on early American Indian tribal culture and how that had attracted the colonial settlers. What were the Indian tribes doing right that appealed so much?
Well, I, you know, again, these are firsthand accounts of the day, including Benjamin Franklin, who sort of mused on this. And this was not welcome news to the colonial authorities. I mean, this was a Christian society that considered itself superior in every way to what they called the savages. And yet, as Ellis said, white people were always running off to join the savages, and not the other way around. No one goes civilized. People just go native. And at the time, in the day, it was thought that the profound egalitarianism of tribal life was what was appealing. And, of course, colonial society replicated English society and was riddled with class divisions. And, you know, you could be born into wealth and power. Among the Iroquois, for example, there is a law called the Iroquois Great Law of Peace, and that held that everyone was born equal and made their own and sort of made their own social status by through their actions. Well, you know, if you have a society like European society that believed in the divine right of kings, that's clearly a departure from that. So it was thought at the time that profound egalitarianism was an enormous draw. I think also the sort of communalism of a hunter-gatherer's existence was probably quite appealing as well.
We have a caller. Let's go to Dave in Caledonia. Hi, Dave.
Hello. A lot of times through American culture, the act of the philosophy of the rugged individualist has been popular. I can remember it through possibly popular culture things such as John Wayne movies. And I guess it's generally, if I'm stereotyping, it's associated with the Republican Party, where Hillary Clinton popularized the phrase, it takes a village. I was wondering if that's part of his research.
Interesting. So
that's a great question. Well, I should say that throughout human society, communities have relied on exceptional individuals to protect them, to invent things, to do essential tasks. So, you know, you have the hero of Beowulf, you have Achilles, you have people like that, and in any tribal society, people depend on great hunters and great warriors, great medicine men, great shamans. So it's not that the individual is unimportant, but that individualism throughout human history has happened in the context of community and in the service of community. One of the things I talk about in my book is the evolutionary origins of liberal and conservative thought. I think one of the real fallacies of the contemporary political atmosphere is the idea that either liberalism or conservatism are completely right. And, you know, I'm politically liberal, and I have a lot of liberal friends who feel that conservatives are completely 100% wrong. And, of course, conservatives think the same thing about liberals. And in truth, those two ideals go back to very ancient evolutionary imperatives and really work best when in balance with each other and in a kind of dynamic tension with each other. And it really is a fallacy of a modern society that one or the other ethos should completely dominate.
Yeah. We are talking with Sebastian Younger, author of Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging. And we welcome your thoughts and questions on this. Would we be better off if we became more of a tribal society? We will talk more about what we can learn from tribal societies. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Sebastian Younger, author of Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging. He's also the author of War and the Perfect Storm. And we are talking about what we can learn from tribal societies. And we are welcoming your questions and maybe even your own experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Eugene in Viola is with us now. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning. Good morning, Joy. I was teaching on an Indian reservation in the 70s in South Dakota. And among white it's in white students in a classroom, you can do question and answer. We are competitive. Among the Native Americans, you cannot do question and answer. They are a cooperative society. They would not compete with each other in the classroom. You could ask all the questions you wanted. They wouldn't compete with each other for question and answers. It just wouldn't work.
So, Sebastian, is that we need to cooperate more and compete less?
Well, I don't. As a society, I have no idea what we need to do. But I think it's interesting to note that there are very different ways of running society than the one that we've devised. I mean, obviously, what we do as a capitalistic, technology-driven society is very successful in some ways. I mean, we have amazing breakthroughs in technology, rule of law, and philosophy. I mean, across the spectrum of human well-being, like we have produced these incredible results. But we're not doing that well in terms of mental health. We know that as income goes up and modernity goes up in a society, the suicide rate tends to go up. Child abuse tends to go up. Depression tends to go up. That would seem counterintuitive, but that's how it works. So clearly, as you lose the communal connection and gain this sort of individualism, which, again, allows for great personal liberty, which is wonderful, but as you lose that communalism, you lose a certain amount of buffering against people's psychological demons. One thing I looked at was what happens when you take modern society and collapse it. How do people respond? I looked at the Blitz in London, and just to remind people, 30,000 Londoners were killed by German bombs during 6 months of air raids. It was a terrible time. And the authorities thought that that there would be rampant psychological issues, mass hysteria, that kind of thing. And the opposite happened. Admissions to psych wards went down during the Blitz. After 9/11 in New York, suicides went down, violent crime went down, all this antisocial behavior went down. So it's really interesting to look at the effect of, quote, disaster on the sort of quality of life in a community. It actually, in a weird way, it actually increases.
How has modern society perfected the art of making people not feel necessary, in your words?
Well, the wealthier the society, the less people need each other in order to survive. So in a traditional hunter-gatherer society, food collection is a completely communal effort. Defense, community defense, is a communal effort. Everything, in fact, is a communal effort. Child rearing, everything. And as societies get wealthier, first there was the invention of agriculture and industry, now sort of high technology, era of high technology. An individual family where there's one or two wage earners in the family can literally, as my family lived, literally have no need to rely on their neighbors for their physical survival. We did not depend on our neighbors for food gathering, for example, in Belmont, Massachusetts in the 1970s. We did not depend on our immediate neighbors to defend ourselves against enemies. We were fine as a single family unit and didn't need connections to others. And as a result, you don't feel needed. Your neighbors don't need you either. And being needed we're a social species, our safety for hundreds of thousands of years, our physical safety has come from the fact that as individuals, we were part of a group. We survive much, much better as a group. And when the reason you're in a group is because the group needs you as well. It's a reciprocal arrangement. When you're not needed by your community, there is a sense, and soldiers get this when they come back from war, there is a sense that you're very, very vulnerable because you're not part of that matrix. And that is, for evolutionary reasons, a very uncomfortable place to be for human beings.
Yeah. And why aren't families enough of a communal group?
Well, for hundreds of thousands of years, we evolved to live in groups of 40, 50, 60 people, maybe up to around 150. That seems to be the size of the living group that we evolved for. A single family can't possibly fight off an enemy tribe or hunt enough to sustain itself. So for evolutionary reasons, we are wired for larger groups. The limitations of just personal relationships within a four- or five-person family, just those alone can't provide all the emotional needs that we have. We really do seem to, again, we're primates, we're a social species, really, we really do seem to need to live in troops, as it were, to feel fully adapted and comfortable. When you take soldiers and put them in a platoon, a platoon is 40 or 50 people, and you put them in a platoon and you put them in a harsh, rugged environment where they're dependent on each other for their survival, that reproduces our evolutionary past very, very closely. And one of the reasons, I think, that soldiers so often say that they miss the war, you know, isn't that they're violent sociopaths. It's that they miss that very close communal connection that they experienced, you know, literally sleeping shoulder to shoulder, taking meals together, doing tasks and missions together. That is our evolutionary past. We're wired for it. And when it's taken away from us again, we miss it.
And in your book, you said that even if soldiers return to their family after a deployment, it's not the same as the group experience that they had in the military. Does the loss of that tribal or group experience at the end of deployment and in the homecoming play a role in PTSD?
Yes, but keep in mind, the T in PTSD refers to trauma, and only about 10% of the military is really engaged in any regular combat, only about 10%. But the rate of application for PTSD disability is far higher than that. And so it's possible that what's happening is something similar to what happens with Peace Corps volunteers. Of course, if you're in the Peace Corps for 2 years in, say, a small village in Cameroon, you have an experience of very close communal connection for a couple of years, maybe analogous to a platoon, and then you come back to modern society, you come back to America, and around 25% of Peace Corps volunteers go into a sudden depression when they come back. Likewise with soldiers. I mean, that's around the rate of psychological distress that soldiers experience, even though far fewer than that experience combat. So what may be going on with this sort of bizarrely high PTSD rate, I mean, a rate that's much higher than the percentage of soldiers in combat, what may be going on is actually a kind of transition disorder from a communal life to a fractured, individualistic, modern one that Peace Corps volunteers have trouble with as well.
Well, maybe we have listeners who have some thoughts on homecoming and belonging, maybe some military members listening along, or anyone who has some thoughts on how we can learn from tribal societies. Our guest is Sebastian Younger, author of Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging. Maybe you have some sort of tribal community going, and you can tell us about that. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Any examples of groups outside the military that are tribal societies? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, what about that? I mean, let's talk a little bit about what are some examples of groups outside of the military in our society that that can create those emotional bonds that people in the military are used to.
I mean, one of the problems is that they're so few and far between. I mean, that's exactly the point of the book. Those communal bonds are formed during catastrophes, for example, the Blitz in London. I looked at an earthquake in Avezzano, Italy, in 1915, where 96% of the population was killed in under a minute, and the survivors sort of huddled around. And what's interesting is that immediately there was class distinctions disappeared, rich and poor disappeared. People were immediately reverted to the kind of egalitarian existence that Benjamin Franklin suspected was so appealing about tribal societies in North America in the 1700s. And one of the survivors wrote about this phenomenon and said this amazing, I'm sort of paraphrasing, but this amazing sentence. He said that the earthquake had produced what the law promises but cannot in fact deliver, which is the equality of all men. So disasters certainly produce that, at least for a little while. I've since writing my book, I've been on book tour, and I at one point encountered a young woman who said that she'd survived cancer, and she said when she was sick, her family, her community, her people, her tribe basically had gathered around her to support her, and she survived, she beat the odds, and she looked at me rather sadly and said, and now I miss being sick.
Oh.
Yeah, and so I've since then I've encountered other people who have said that on cancer wards, there is incredibly death row cells in prisons, an incredibly close community of people all facing death together and relying on each other emotionally and physically to face the unfaceable. And then it creates an incredibly strong community and that the survivors, people who have been exonerated from death row or people who have actually survived their cancer and returned to society, one of the things they say is that they miss the community of death row or of the cancer ward, and that people on the outside don't understand what they've been through, which sounds exactly like what soldiers say when they try to return to society.
Yeah. In your research, you found that people organize themselves in the interest of community when disaster strikes, but after the danger is gone, everything reverts back to the way it was. That happens, I mentioned when we were trying to get you back on the telephone line that we had was not exactly a tornado, but a lot of storm damage yesterday, and people, neighbors were helping neighbors, and everybody kind of had this common disaster to talk about and help each other out. Happens after blizzards here in Wisconsin, too. Where the neighbor will shovel us out and that sort of thing, push cars out of the ditches. And why is that? Why does everything revert back to the way it was after the disaster is over?
Well, our communal impulses are necessitated by hardship, and when that hardship disappears, they're not needed anymore, and we revert to something else that I'm sure was supported by our evolutionary past, which is individualism. I mean, they exist in a kind of dynamic tension. And as things get worse, we become more collaborative, or what we think of as our higher human qualities emerge. I mean, as things get bad, humans act better. And when things get good, humans act worse because they act more selfishly, more individualistically. And so I think probably in evolutionary terms what's happened is that we evolve so that we deal with dangerous we deal with danger and hardship communally, and then when those things are not threatening us, we revert to a kind of individualism that allows for other exceptional behaviors. I mean, it's individuals that invent things. You know, it's individuals that become artists, become shamans. I mean, it's not that individualism is entirely bad, but what we need in evolutionary terms is a sort of dynamic tension between them where our communalism rises up when we're facing adversity.
Now we have full lines, so let's take some more calls. Joe in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Joe.
Hi. I guess my take on this issue of tribalism is, I think there are instances, I guess, in our own lives when someone stops and helps us, and that's very nice. But I think there are tribal cultures or tribal nations, I guess. What I'm thinking of is social democracies, for example, in Scandinavia. I think I've lived in one, Canada. In other words, they pay much higher taxes, but there's concern for people's, for example, health care. Child taking care of, people actually are paid when they have a child. The society, in other words, pitches in at all sorts of levels in this society to help. We are not that type of country or society in many ways. In other words, until you get Medicare, really you're dependent on your employer for health care. And there's really an attitude in this country, and I don't think it's something that it necessarily exists in other societies, where, as the ones I mentioned earlier, the social democracies, where sort of the sense is, I have mine, I don't really care. I have health care. I don't care about the poor in this society. I don't care about people who, are not getting support, for example, when they have a child, when they get time off, yeah, and get paid for it. And these are things that are taken for granted in other societies. So I think tribalism does exist in that sense, in national, national entities.
Yeah. All right. Sebastian?
Yeah, I mean, what we're doing with nations is something that's never been attempted before, which is to create a communal a sort of shared goal, sort of shared concerns among 300 million people in this country. That's never been attempted before. So the caller is exactly right. I mean, there are social democracies such as Canada, where you take that sort of very communal tribal ethos of a common good and people taking care of each other, and you try to project it onto a much larger screen, the screen of the modern nation state. It's an awkward fit, but it can be done. We're not really doing that in this country, but we're certainly doing it a lot more than we used to. I mean, 150 years ago, we didn't have Social Security. We didn't have health care. This country as well has been moving towards a kind of collective responsibility for society as a whole. It hasn't gone as far as the caller would like, but it certainly moved in that direction in the last 200 years.
Thank you, Joe. Next we go to Rachel in La Crosse. Hello, Rachel.
Hello. I just wanted to comment about my experience with this. I actually was in the military for 9 years, and I was deployed to Iraq for about 3 to 4 months. And it was incredible, the feeling that I had when I came back. And all I can say about it was that I felt lost when I came back to the United States, even being just there 3 to 4 months. And I think for me what it was you have this structure. You have the same thing you wear every day. You know you're going to go exercise. You know you have your duty to do. You have a purpose. You're serving your nation. And everything is just so regimented. And you have one kind of hot sauce you can use on your eggs. And, you know, but you get back to the United States and it seems like chaos. There's so many choices. There's so many things happening all over the place. You have the choice of what time you want to get up in the morning. You have the choice of where you want to go exercise. You don't have that when you're in Iraq. And you feel, I just felt completely lost. And it was scary. It was very scary when I first came back. And it's a very unique feeling, I think, that you feel when you come back from such a structured environment.
Yeah, was it just the structure, Rachel, or what about the cohesiveness or the bonding with your other your military members that you were working with?
Sure. I mean, I definitely think that had a part to do with it as well, although I feel a great bond with the people that I work with in my company here in La Crosse. I don't have any issues with that, but yeah, that could be part of it.
So she missed that structure. She felt lost when she came back. Have you heard that before, Sebastian?
Yeah, and keep in mind that structure was in the context of her unit, her platoon, or whatever unit she was in. When I was with the military as a civilian reporter in eastern Afghanistan, one of the things I noticed is that you were never out of sight, usually out of touching range of other people. I mean, we slept shoulder to shoulder on the ground. We took our meals together, patrols, everything. Everything happened in a group. And that truly is our evolutionary past recreated. And it was very structured. I mean, even in the chaos of combat, it was quite structured. And so I think the woman who just called actually is... I think she's actually talking about both things simultaneously, even though she might not realize it. And I should add that those bewildering chaos of choices that she confronted when she came home is also a wonderful thing. It might be confusing and disorienting, but there's an incredible benefit to having a multitude of choices. And so my only point, it's not that modern society is somehow bad. It's amazing. It's an amazing society. But there are psychological consequences for abruptly living outside of what has been our evolutionary past for hundreds of thousands of years. And that does seem to be what we're doing.
We are talking with Sebastian Younger. He is author of Tribe, On Homecoming and Belonging. And we will continue after this break, and we'll continue taking more of your calls. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Joy Cardine with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking with author and freelance journalist Sebastian Younger about his latest book, Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. Have you ever had an experience with a group, perhaps in the military or in the Peace Corps, where you experienced great connectivity? Tell us about your experience. How were things different when you returned? Why do you think we're not connected enough as a society? Or do you think that? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Steve in Chippewa Falls is with us next. Hello, Steve.
Hi. I used to be in the military also. And I can't help but wonder if this is sort of a romanticized version of being in the military. And the numbers bear me out. A person returning from the military is 6 or 7 times as likely to commit suicide as someone who never went at all. There's 22 people a day committing suicide when they're veterans. There's something that they're getting damaged in the military. They're not getting edified.
Sebastian?
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem seems to be, like with Peace Corps volunteers, doesn't seem to be the experience in the military. The suicide rate during deployment is extremely low. I assume during Peace Corps work as well. The problem seems to be the transition home. And as I said earlier, that's true regardless of whether the person was in combat. Most of the military actually does not see combat. But a very large percentage experience psychological difficulties when they come back. So it seems, though, as though trauma actually is not necessarily the operative problem. They're also statistically having a hard time connecting suicide to combat. There's a very, very slight statistical connection between being in one of the few combat units and an increased risk of suicide. What is a strong predictor of suicide post-deployment is suicidal ideation and mental health issues before deployment. That's quite a strong connection. So it's a really complicated arena, and even the medical profession is not anywhere close to a consensus on how it all works.
But, and Sebastian, you're not glorifying the military in this book or in this conversation. You're saying that there's some positives to be had when it comes to the tribal community that they had.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm pointing out our evolutionary past and saying that 99% of it was spent in close communal situations, and that is replicated by the military. It has enormous psychological advantages, and then when you lose that, when you come home, from anything, it doesn't have to be the military, when you lose that, it's quite difficult, and those difficulties reveal deficits in our own society. I mean, clearly, when you have suicide and depression rates as incredibly high as you do in this society, there's a problem.
Back to the phones, and Bill in Madison with us now. Hello, Bill.
Hello.
Yes, hi. What's your story?
Well, just a couple of comments. First of all, I think that what Mr. Younger is talking about is a social behavior aspect of what's been called the Paleolithic prescription, which has become very popular in respect to diet and so forth. But a couple of questions I'd like to ask his comments on. First of all, there's good reason to believe from psychology that our experience of others is deeply problematic, that the self at some level kind of resents the other, and that people, granted, are social creatures and are drawn together by necessity, which can be set aside when we're wealthy. We don't then depend on other people directly, as he's pointed out. A nun, my Filipina nun my son met at school, when he was writing a thesis on community in America, she said, well, Americans don't do community, they're rich. This reminds me of the parable of the rich man and the eye of the needle, and the idea that wealth is a danger to your soul, so to speak. The other, I wonder if he'd comment on that, and also the question of the role of ritual in kind of mediating relationships among people. Ritual in the strong sense of acts that are prescribed by someone and a kind of radical deference to the prerogatives of the other.
But I'm sorry, Bill, we've got so many things to talk about here that I'm getting a little lost here. Is there a role of ritual in a tribal community, Sebastian?
Yeah, I mean, all societies use ritual to clarify the relationships between people and the group, and to demonstrate the different passages that people pass through during their lifetimes. Ritual is extremely important. And to go back to the beginning of the gentleman's comments, we are wired to survive in a group. We survive better in a group than in as an individual. You put 12 people in the wilderness, they're more likely to survive than 12 individual people on their own in the wilderness. And all the primate species are that way. And if you look at a troop, a chimpanzee troop, they're very communal. But there's enormous conflicts between individual chimpanzees and the troop. I mean, this isn't some kind of blissful utopia. What evolutionary psychologists point out is that we just do it better as a group. We're safer. We get our emotional needs met. It's what we're wired for.
Thank you for the call, Bill. Next, we go to Sid in Hollandale. Hello.
Good morning. Good morning. Just another soldier calling in.
Well,
from the age of 19 when I got drafted for the war in Vietnam to the age of 40, I was in the military. And the big thing about a military community, you know, we move a lot. When you moved into a new community, all of the wives were there to help your wife set up the house. You know, people were there to greet you. There was all kinds of support. When I retired and came back to the real world, the first thing is people don't even talk the same language we do. And I had neighbors for 6-7 months that I never met, never made the effort to come out and say hi to me. I would go and knock on the door and introduce myself. It's just entirely different.
And what kind of different language do we speak, Sid?
Well, in the military, we speak a lot in acronyms. Okay, I was in SAC at an Alcom base.
Right.
Okay, so just things like that. It's just...
like snafus and that sort of thing.
Exactly. So it was a real hard adjustment. I went through a lot of depression. You know, you get away from the day-to-day rush of doing your job and, you know, the sense of urgency and of purpose that I had for 21 years in the military wasn't there in a civilian job. You know, I told one of my bosses one day, I said, I've gone from being a highly decorated defender of the free world to fixing toilets. Mm-hmm. Both were important jobs. Both needed to be done, but I'm sure you understand the difference.
Yeah, and do you still have a community with the military in any way, Sid?
Well, you know, I work in Madison. My office is right next to Truax Air Force Base. I go over and have lunch in the NCO club and you know, belong to different military organizations. And as far as tribe goes, I've got 4 kids and 8 grandkids. I have my own tribe.
Thank you for calling, and thank you for your service. Well, Sebastian, what's your reaction to that story?
Well, you'll notice that gentleman wasn't necessarily in combat. He was in a Strategic Air Command unit, mm-hmm. It sounds like, if I heard it correctly. And he might not have been in combat, but he was profoundly depressed when he came back and when he finished his service. And that's the point, is that some of the depression that today's vets experience isn't necessarily trauma. It's this transition, and that's important because their distress reflects on us, not on them. It reflects on what's missing in the society that they come home to. Unless we think this is just sort of macho soldiers having a reaction, I was in Sarajevo during the siege of Sarajevo in the early 90s, the first war that I reported on. And as many of your listeners will remember, it was a modern city that was besieged by a modern army. And for 3 years, that army used the civilians of Sarajevo for target practice. They killed or wounded one-fifth of the population, 20% of the population of that poor city. And I went back for the first time since the war, last summer, actually, and I spoke with a woman named Nizara, who was a journalist, and I actually interviewed her. She was, at age 17, a 17-year-old girl, at the beginning of the war, she was badly wounded by fragments from a Serb tank round. And she almost lost her leg, and they saved her leg, but they had to operate on her without anesthesia, if you can imagine what that felt like. Well, she said to me last summer, almost embarrassed, she, like, literally lowered her voice. We were at a cafe, and she lowered her voice, and she said, you know, the truth is the war was terrible, but we all miss it. Now, these are civilians missing the war. And what she said was that, of course, we don't miss the war. She said, but we miss who we were during the war. We were better people. We were generous. We lived for each other. We lived communally. Now we have peacetime, we have more wealth, and we live our individual lives. We're selfish, and we're lesser people. And it's a very common sentiment in Sarajevo that people miss those terrible days of the siege because they were living communally.
Joe in Wausau is another veteran. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I was in the Marine Corps for 4 years, never saw any combat, moved all over, was obviously in a platoon with other Marines, and I had a real tough time after I got out. I was very depressed for years, drank heavily, trying to find something that just wasn't out there. And I think the big difference for me isn't so much the regiment, the structure, the over and over again. It's the amount of time you spend with an individual, and in that time you get to really deeply know that individual, that other person, that other soul, that other being, those other thoughts. And in today's society, in American society, everything is now, now, now. It's go, go, go. Electronics are somehow a friend. And I think it's more that that it is eroding or has eroded or is contributing to eroding society and communities and tribes.
Yeah.
That military tribe works very well, I think, because you really get to know that person you're sleeping next to, training with. You get to know their backstory. Maybe their mom had cancer. Maybe their dad died young. Maybe they're poor. Maybe they were in jail.
And Joe, I got to jump in because we have less than a minute to go. Sebastian, exactly.
Well, we're hearing variations on the theme here with your callers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's interesting, the consistency. I heard of a gentleman who was an author, and there was a murder in his neighborhood, and he was so upset at the lack of communal reaction to this tragedy that he spent a year, and he wrote a book. I can't remember the name of the book, but he wrote a book chronicling how for a year he slept in the homes of all his neighbors with these families that he didn't know, just in an attempt to get to know them and create some kind of communal bond around this tragedy.
Isn't that something? Well, I guess as we wrap up, what's the takeaway for listeners?
Well, for me, the takeaway is an awareness that we are a communal species, that we prefer it that way. We'll even think nostalgically about terrible times like disasters, like the Blitz, because it brings out our better, what we call our better natures, our communal, our selfless communal selves. And that if we can retain the benefits of this wealthy modern society, but reinstill communal values into the way we run this country, into the way we run our cities and our neighborhoods, if we can do that, we truly will sort of have it all, as it were. I feel in the current political atmosphere, we're very, very far from that, but that doesn't mean it can't change.
Thank you very much for being with us. Sebastian Younger, author of Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging. Thanks to producers Kai Brito and Brianne Chasso. This is the Ideas Network.